Welcome to January 16th, 2024 of the Common Era. Time is 1924 hours Eastern Standard Time, and actually 1924, just by coincidence, it happens to be the birth year of my late wife, and I've figured out since I talked about it yesterday that it's been since her death either 6 years and some months or 7 years, 1 month and some days, depending on how you want to express it, from her death. But her yesterday was the 100th anniversary of the birth of Ann Ruth Rutledge, my late wife. So today's study, little children, we have the beginning of chapter 5, which is called Hatshepsut, Foremost of Noble Ladies. And in paragraph 1, which is our study, we may begin to read, first of all, the proverb or the scripture that is used to highlight this chapter is: a woman of charm is the one that takes hold of glory, but the tyrants, for their part, take hold of riches. Proverbs 11 and 16. Wow. How appropriate is that? The city of Jericho, called the city of palm trees, was recaptured by Eglon 48 years after the Israelites took Jericho. The number 48 can be derived, as shown in other places in the articles, such as Moses and Crucible, where we talk about it in the book of Judges. After the Israelites took Jericho, 48 years was what we date the beginning of the contrary opposing rule of Eglon against the Israelites, or what do we call that again? The oppression of the nations among whom the Israelites were living after they took the promised land. So Eglon began to oppress them 48 years after 1452, which would be 1404 BCE. And in the book of Judges, chapter 3, is where we can refer people to read about that in the Bible. This is of interest because there is evidence from graves at ancient Jericho. Yes, there's evidence from graves at ancient Jericho which appears connected to this period. This is really important chronologically. The main burial place at Jericho was the nearby necropolis to the northwest, in which archaeologist Mr. John Garstang found scarabs bearing the names of Egyptian pharaohs, even one of Hatshepsut, the female king of Egypt who reigned, as we express here. These dates might be very slightly modified in what we later give, but I think the first one is the same. 1490 is the beginning date, remains the same in our later work. 1469 might become 1468, but that might stay the same, come to think of it. But it's something very close to these dates, 1490 to 1469, for the rule of Hatshepsut, as we explain in greater detail further on. So if there's a scarab from a pharaoh in a grave, that says, well, the pharaoh must have been ruling at the time, or it must either have been at the time the pharaoh ruled. Obviously, it couldn't be before the pharaoh ruled. So it's either at the time the pharaoh ruled or later. That's what these scarabs tell us. As a contemporary artifact, right, if it was at the same time as she was ruling, in other words, a scarab of Pharaoh Hatshepsut places the fall of Jericho no earlier than 1490, because, you know, it couldn't have been deposited in the grave before she began to rule Egypt as king or pharaoh. So her first year of rule was 1490, so it had to be after that when the scarab was put in the grave. So that, and therefore, what are we saying about the fall of Jericho? Once Jericho fell, the Israelites would not be putting any Egyptian scarabs, you know, anywhere. They wouldn't put them in their graves. their graves. But we later show how. I'm just trying to think, why is this? I'm trying to think why this is. I've forgotten this. I prepared this study of today, too. I just can't remember. Anyway, this is what it says. We'll have to come back to it later and figure it out. No earlier than 1490, it places the fall of Jericho. Why? Well, because, you know, the placement of this scarab happened after the fall of Jericho, is what we're saying. That's right. That's right, because it was during the time of Eglon, okay? And that was, he oppressed Israel after they conquered Jericho. Since we later show she was Pharaoh in those years, 1490 to 1469, also, you know, that's why it couldn't be earlier than 1490 for the fall of Jericho. But whereas the scarab may have been produced as late as 1469 BCE, the city fell no earlier than 1469 BCE. Right, if the scarab was produced as that late, then of course the city must have fallen after that time. But 1452 is our date, and it is after that time, so that's perfectly fine. Of the two other scarabs having the names of Thutmose III and Amenhotep III engraved upon them, we even have more scarabs from Egypt. That's really good, the evidence from Jericho. The gap between the respective reigns of the pharaohs, you know, knowing what we know about those two pharaohs, is between 33 and 121 years, which we later in this article show. The reign of Thutmose III as 1490 to 1440 BCE, I think it's 1493, he backdates it to 1493, to 1439 is the end point, but that's still 1440 is okay, and it's close enough. And because Amenhotep could have been, of course, also beginning to rule, he could have co-ruled. There are a lot of intricacies. We don't want to be too dogmatic, but also Amenhotep's rule, Amenhotep III, we give later in this article as 1407 to 1369. So 1369, 100 years after 1469, and that's Amenhotep III. Wow, so they actually found a scarab from his reign. That's incredible, right? That's really remarkable, which gives a 33-year minimum. Isn't that remarkable? It is remarkable to find that, isn't it? So there's a 33-year minimum and a 120-year maximum spread for the placement of those two scarabs if they were contemporary with the pharaohs, which, you know, they could have been later, of course, than the pharaohs. But this places Jericho's fall. They wouldn't have been later than, let's say, Eglon, because after Eglon, nobody lived there. So after he was defeated by Ehud, the Israelite savior, this places Jericho's fall to Israel. Jericho's fall to Israel in the days of Joshua, during the reign of Thutmose III, because it couldn't have been earlier than 1469, as we said. Let's see that. Yeah. Fascinating. Why? I did so much research, and I really had a lot of good reasoning incorporated into this article. It was a very, really well-researched article. So we're going to have to think about this and see what we can think about overnight, too. During the reign of Thutmose III is where Jericho must have fallen, according to this article that we're reading, the Crucible article. Chapter 5, paragraph 1. Why? Well, yeah. Well, the early one shows it had to be after 1469, but the later scarabs, they might have even been placed during the time of Eglon, whereas Hatshepsut could not have been. But when we look at the 18 years, let's just keep reading, the 18 years of King Eglon together with the 48 years for the early judges is 66 years, giving us 1386 BCE for the date Ehud defeated Eglon, which is nearly year 22 of Amenhotep III. Right. And so that scarab of the latest of those three pharaohs, Amenhotep III, could easily have been placed during those years and could have been contemporary with Eglon ruling at Jericho when he oppressed the Israelites during his time, which ended in 1386, and the time period of Amenhotep is 1407 to 1369, within which 1386 falls. So, and the grave, or the scarab, I should say, of Amenhotep III was found in a grave at Jericho. So it's really, really good correspondence there. There were no scarabs found at Jericho later than Amenhotep III, apparently. Someone dying shortly before or after Eglon's defeat in 1386 could account for this scarab. For Amenhotep III ruled 38 years. And that was year 22 when Eglon was defeated. So it's a good... it's good. It's food for thought, too. We need to keep on meditating on these facts as they've been obtained through archaeology. So... But it's remarkable that the dating we have for Eglon just corresponds so well there. But why does our discussion place... I mean, we know our chronology places Jericho's fall to Israel in 1452 BCE, which is during the reign of Thutmose III, who ruled from 1490 to 1440, as given in this paragraph. Right. But, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, well, it couldn't have been during the reign of Hatshepsut, unless, well, it could have been, except we already have our date of 1452, so couldn't have been. What was I thinking there? I'm trying to get back into the mindset. Well, she was not alive to witness Joshua's destruction, Hatshepsut, in paragraph 2 here. She took the title King of Egypt. Well, we're going to... It goes into different subject matter there. So let's say that's all for our Crucible article for today. Now, I'm not sure why all the details are given exactly as they are in that paragraph, so we need to reconsider later. Our proverb for today, little children, is from Ecclesiastes 2 and 2, which says, I said to laughter, insanity, and to rejoicing, what is this doing? So Solomon, who wrote that, he tried everything, including laughter and to an extreme degree, and rejoicing. All these things he was trying to see if he could learn more about this vanity that he called things. Everything was vanity. Life was vain to him. And this is it's a true statement, according to Ecclesiastes. That's the theme of Ecclesiastes, that life is vanity. Kings. 1 Kings, chapter 22. And for 3 years they continued dwelling without war between Syria and Israel. And it came about in the third year that Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, proceeded to go down to the king of Israel. Then the king of Israel said to his servants, do you really know that Ramoth-Gilead belongs to us? Yet we are hesitating to take it out of the hand of the king of Assyria. And he went on to say to Jehoshaphat, "Will you go with me to the fight at Ramoth-Gilead?" At this, Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, "I am the same as you. My people are the same as your people. My horses are the same as your horses." However, Jehoshaphat went on to say to the king of Israel, "Inquire, please, first of all, for the word of Jehovah." So the king of Israel collected the prophets together, about 400 men, and said to them, "Shall I go against Ramoth-Gilead in war, or shall I refrain?" And they began to say, "Go up, and Jehovah will give it into the king's hand." But Jehoshaphat said, "Is there not here a prophet of Jehovah still? Then let us inquire through him." At that, the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, "There is still one man through whom to inquire of Jehovah, but I myself certainly hate him, for he does not prophesy good things concerning me, but bad. Micaiah, the son of Imlah." However, Jehoshaphat said, "Do not let the king say a thing like that." Accordingly, the king of Israel called a certain court official and said, "Do bring Micaiah, the son of Imlah, quickly." Now the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, were sitting each one on his throne, clothed in garments, in the thrashing floor at the entrance of the gate of Samaria, and all the prophets were acting as prophets before them. Then Zedekiah, the son of Kenaanah, made for himself horns of iron and said, "This is what Jehovah has said. With these you will push the Syrians until you exterminate them." And all the other prophets were prophesying the same as that, saying, "Go up to Ramoth-Gilead and prove successful, and Jehovah will certainly give it into the king's hand." And the messenger that had gone to call Micaiah spoke to him, saying, "Look now, the words of the prophets are unanimously of good to the king. Let your word, please, become like the word of one of them, and you must speak good." But Micaiah said, As Jehovah is living, what Jehovah will say to me, that is what I shall speak." I just got a tickle in my throat right when I tried to say Jehovah. Then he came into the king, and the king proceeded to say to him, "Micaiah, shall we go to Ramoth-Gilead in war, or shall we refrain?" At once he said to them, "Go up and prove successful, and Jehovah will certainly give it into the king's hand." At that the king said to him, "For how many times am I putting you under oath that you should not speak to me anything but truth in the name of Jehovah?" So he said, I certainly see all the Israelites scattered on the mountains like sheep that have no shepherd." And Jehovah went on to say, "These have no masters. Let them go back, each one to his house in peace." Then the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, "Did I not say to you, he will prophesy concerning me not good things but bad?" And he went on to say, "Therefore hear the word of Jehovah. I certainly see Jehovah sitting upon his throne, and all the army of the heavens standing by him to his right and to his left." This is Micaiah continuing his prophecy. And Jehovah proceeded to say, "Who will fool Ahab that he may go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead?" And this one began to say something like this, while that one was saying something like that. Finally, a spirit came out and stood before Jehovah and said, "I myself shall fool him." At that, Jehovah said to him, "By what means?" To this he said, "I shall go forth, and I shall certainly become a deceptive spirit in the mouth of all his prophets." So he said, "You will fool him, and what is more, you will come off the winner. Go out and do that way." And now here, Jehovah has put a deceptive spirit into the mouth of all these prophets of yours, but Jehovah himself has spoken calamity concerning you. Zedekiah the son of Kenaanah now approached and struck Micaiah upon the cheek and said, "In just which way did the spirit of Jehovah pass along from me to speak with you?" At that Micaiah said, "Look, you are seeing which way on the day when you will enter the innermost chamber to hide yourself." Then the king of Israel said, "Take Micaiah and turn him back to Amon, the chief of the city, and to Joash, the king's son. And you must say, this is what the king said. Put this fellow in the house of detention and feed him with a reduced allowance of bread and a reduced allowance of water until I come in peace." Upon that, Micaiah said, "If you return at all in peace, Jehovah has not spoken with me." And he added, "Hear, all you peoples." And the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, proceeded to go up to Ramoth-Gilead. The king of Israel now said to Jehoshaphat, "There will be a disguising and entering into the battle for me." This is what Ahab said. "But you, for your part, put on your garments." Accordingly, the king of Israel disguised himself and entered into the battle. As for the king of Syria, he had commanded the 32 chiefs of the chariots that were his, saying, you must fight neither with the small nor the great, but with the king of Israel alone. And it came about that as soon as the chiefs of the chariots saw Jehoshaphat, they for their part said to themselves, surely it is the king of Israel. So they turned aside against him to fight, and Jehoshaphat began to cry for aid. And it came about as soon as the chiefs of the chariots saw that it was not the king of Israel, they immediately came back from following him. And there was a man that bent the bow in his innocence, but he got to strike the king of Israel between the appendages and the coat of mail, so that he said to his charioteer, turn your hand around and take me out from the camp, because I have been badly wounded. And the battle kept rising in intensity on that day, and the king himself had to be kept in a standing position in the chariot facing the Syrians, and gradually he died in the evening, and the blood of the wound kept pouring out upon the interior of the war chariot. So Ahab died, and the ringing cry began to pass through the camp about the setting of the sun, saying, everyone to his city and everyone to his land. Thus the king died. When he was brought to Samaria, then they buried the king in Samaria, and they began to wash off the war chariot by the pool of Samaria, and the dogs went licking up his blood, and the prostitutes themselves bathed there, according to Jehovah's word that he had spoken. Remember the prophecy about the blood of Ahab? Right. In the place where the dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, the dogs will lick up your blood, even yours. Wait, I just clicked on something there. Hang on. Right. I just had a footnote. I tried to get to it. Here it is, 1 Kings 21:19, which we've already read, of course. Elijah the Tishbite. Elijah had prophesied that about the dogs licking up the blood. Okay. As for the rest of the affairs of Ahab and all that he did and the house of ivory that he built and all the cities that he built, are they not written in the book of the affairs of the days of the kings of Israel? Finally, Ahab lay down with his forefathers, and Ahaziah his son began to reign in place of him. As for Jehoshaphat, the son of Asa, he had become king over Judah in the fourth year of Ahab, the king of Israel. Jehoshaphat was 35 years old when he began to reign, and for 25 years he reigned in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Azubah, the daughter of Shilhi. And he kept walking in all the way of Asa, his father. He did not turn aside from it by doing what was right in the eyes of Jehovah. Only the high places themselves did not disappear. Right. The people were still sacrificing and making sacrificial smoke on the high places. And Jehoshaphat kept peaceful relations with the king of Israel. As for the rest of the affairs of Jehoshaphat and the mightiness with which he acted and how he warred, are they not written in the book of the affairs of the days of the kings of Judah? And the rest of the male temple prostitutes that had been left over in the days of Asa, his father, he cleared out from the land. As regards a king, there was none in Edom. A deputy was king. Jehoshaphat, for his part, made Tarshish ships to go to Ophir for gold, but they did not go because the ships were wrecked at Ezion-Geber. It was then that Ahaziah the son of Ahab said to Jehoshaphat, let my servants go with your servants in the ships, but Jehoshaphat did not consent. Finally, Jehoshaphat lay down with his forefathers and was buried with his forefathers in the city of David his forefather, and Jehoram his son began to reign in place of him. As for Ahaziah the son of Ahab, he became king over Israel in Samaria in the 17th year of Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, and he continued to reign over Israel for 2 years, and he kept doing what was bad in Jehovah's eyes and went walking in the way of his father and in the way of his mother and in the way of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who had caused Israel to sin. And he continued serving Baal, and bowing down to him did Ahaziah, and kept offending Jehovah, the God of Israel, according to all that his father Ahab had done. We look at this. That's not it. Wait a minute. Here it is. That's what I wanted to show. The kings of Israel. After Ahab came Ahaziah, and his year one is 900. In our article, Moses, part two of that article. And Jehoshaphat started to rule here in 916 in the same table. And we see it was year 17 that Ahaziah began to rule. Okay. In the genealogy. So it fits quite well. Ezekiel, we're at chapter 24. And the word of Jehovah continued to occur to me in the ninth year, in the tenth month, on the tenth day of the month. This is important because it shows how long the siege was and when it began, in the ninth year and the tenth month of their exile. Saying, Son of man, write down for yourself the name of the day, this selfsame day. The king of Babylon has thrown himself against Jerusalem on this selfsame day. And compose a proverbial saying concerning the rebellious house, and you must say concerning them. And then we go on, but we're not going to have time to read all this. But he says, in the same day that this prophecy occurred, Ezekiel's wife died as well. And he was told not to mourn his wife. It's very interesting. And Clark makes an interesting comment on this. In Clark's commentary for Ezekiel 24, he says, another sign of the greatness of those calamities is the reason why the prophet is forbidden to mourn for his wife. So the calamities are so great, of whom he is to be deprived, intimating thereby that the sufferings of the Jews should be so astonishing as to surpass all expressions of grief, and that private sorrow, however affectionate and tender the object, ought to be absorbed in the public calamities. That is a marvelous statement Clark makes there. We're not going to have time to read all of it, but basically the Israelites are instructed to do the same way as Ezekiel does. In their mourning for Jerusalem, as they're living now in Babylon with Ezekiel, but Ezekiel is treating the mourning of his wife the same way that they are to do for Jerusalem. They're not to mourn over Jerusalem. It says here, in verse 25, and as for you, O son of man, will it not be in the day of my taking away from them their fortress, the beautiful object of their exultation, the thing desirable to their eyes and the longing of their soul? In that day there will come to you the escaped one for making the ears hear. And that happens in Ezekiel 33, chapter 33. The escaped one comes to Ezekiel in the 12th year. But this is in the 9th year, the 10th month, and the 10th day of the month. So that tells us, we know that it fell in the 11th year of Zedekiah. So it's 10 years and some months, and it's not the 10th month, it's less. So that's how we get the 18 months for the siege. Because this is the beginning of the siege from Ezekiel 24 and 1, which is really important for the chronology, and I never noticed that before. Actually, I never used that in the chronology, but that really solves the problems. When they did come in chapter, the escaped one in chapter 33, verse 21 of Ezekiel, it was the 12th year of the 10th month on the 5th day of the month, but it was the 10th month, which wasn't the, it was 5 months, you know, it was not close to the time of year when the city fell, which was the 5th month. So it was a year, but actually it was in the 11th year that the city fell. So this would be a year and 5 months after the city fell that this escaped one came from Jerusalem to Ezekiel in Babylon to tell him about the city's falling or having fallen. Now we're coming to Revelation. We did chapter 15 already. Where's 16? I'm looking for it here. Here it is. Okay. And I heard a loud voice out of the sanctuary say to the seven angels, go and pour out the seven bowls of the anger of God into the earth. And the first one went off and poured out his bowl into the earth, and a hurtful and malignant ulcer came to be upon the men that had the mark of the wild beast and that were worshipping its image. The second one poured out his bowl into the sea, and it became blood as of a dead man, and every living soul died, yes, the things in the sea. And the third one poured out his bowl into the rivers and the fountains of the waters, and they became blood. And I heard the angel over the water say, You, the one who is and who was the loyal one, are righteous because you have rendered these decisions, because they poured out the blood of holy ones and of prophets, and you have given them blood to drink. They deserve it. And I heard the altar say, Yes, Jehovah God, the Almighty, true and righteous, are your judicial decisions. And the fourth one poured out his bowl upon the sun, and to the sun it was granted to scorch the men with fire. And the men were scorched with great heat, but they blasphemed the name of God who has the authority over these plagues, and they did not repent so as to give glory to him. And the fifth one poured out his bowl upon the throne of the wild beast, and its kingdom became darkened, and they began to gnaw their tongues for their pain, but they blasphemed the God of heaven for their pains and for their altars, and they did not repent of their works. And the sixth one poured out his bowl upon the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up, that the way might be prepared for the kings from the rising of the sun. And I saw three unclean, inspired expressions that looked like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the wild beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. They are, in fact, expressions inspired by demons and perform signs, and they go forth to the kings of the entire inhabited earth to gather them together to the war of the great day of God the Almighty. Look, I am coming as a thief. Happy is the one that stays awake and keeps his outer garments, that he may not walk naked, and people look upon his shamefulness. And they gathered them together to the place that is called in Hebrew, Harmageddon. And the seventh one poured out his bowl upon the air. At this a loud voice issued out of the sanctuary from the throne, saying, It has come to pass. And lightnings and voices and thunders occurred, and a great earthquake occurred such as had not occurred since men came to be on the earth, so extensive an earthquake, so great. And the great city was split into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell, and Babylon the Great was remembered in the sight of God to give her the cup of the wine of the anger of his wrath. Also every island fled, and mountains were not found. And a great hail, with every stone about the weight of a talent, descended out of heaven upon the men. And the men blasphemed God due to the plague of hail, because the plague of it was unusually great. It's the end of Revelation chapter 16. And we have 30 seconds, so our time was well used, but we didn't get to read Ezekiel. So you may wish to read that yourselves, little children, but it's basically a very nice thing, as described by Clark, that Ezekiel was mourning his wife on the same day as he prophesied about the mourning for Jerusalem, which had been besieged on that same day. So now, it's January 16th, 2024 of the Common Era, and the time is 1957, hours Eastern Standard Time. I was born in the year 1957 of the Common Era, coincidentally. And I'm Ward Green, and in behalf of me, this is Gully and this is Cassie, saying bye for now.